Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And yep.
As always, we start once more with your emails. And as we said last week, we have so many at this point that we have to pick and choose. And these are emails that I have not even read. I'll start with one from Tony Zip, who wrote in after listening to last week's broadcast to say, "Unfortunately, I feel compelled to weigh in about your mispronunciation of the city Regina and your discomfort about how the correct pronunciation of that rhymes with vagina. As individuals whose job it is to comment on scientific matters, I would have hoped that names of the human anatomy would not embarrass you. I enjoy your show. Look forward to more commentary on scientific discoveries and developments. Thanks for your work and presentation." It's more, I don't know how to explain this. It doesn't embarrass me when we're talking about that. If we're talking about human anatomy, those words are the words attached to human anatomy. It's more when, what I was trying to convey is, it's hard for me to assume that a city name sounds exactly like a part of the human anatomy we don't talk about too often, you know, in real life.
I just enjoyed it because it took me back to that trip that my family and I went on to Canada. And Mariana wrote in about some of the towns that I mentioned along the way on that highway between Winnipeg and Calgary.
Medicine Hat?
Medicine Hat. She lived near Medicine Hat. She says, "I happened to live near Medicine Hat, Alberta, for 25 years and loved hearing the city name on your program. My husband was born in Moose Jaw." I mentioned Moose Jaw. "There's also Swift Current." Do not forget about Swift Current. There was no love for Swift Current in any of the emails that we got. But, yeah.
We're kind of poking fun or laughing at a couple place names in Canada, to be fair.
No, I love them. I'm not poking fun at all. I love those names.
Yeah. Well, here in Germany, you've got quite a few as well that are just odd. A couple that come to mind. Essen, which means
food
or eating.
Yeah.
The European Space Center or European Space Agency, the operations that manage all of the Martian projects, are in Darmstadt. Yeah, it's in a city that would be translated as Intestine City. So, place names are funny.
Yeah,
I think you can laugh. This is from Sandra. "Hi, I just heard the Ick Factor clip." This was a study I talked about last week, looking at 84 TikTok videos and how people describe when they feel something called the ick, which is this instant disgust, permanent disgust you feel toward a romantic partner after they do something small that turns you off.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "I laughed a lot. Thank you, Gabe, for sharing your amusement at the butt crack as one of the icks. It highlighted one thing I love about your show, taking things seriously, but not always taking yourself so seriously. I appreciate the balance. I'm a heterosexual female," which means she would have fit into the study.
Mm-hmm.
"And my ick is a guy chewing with his mouth open. I remember visiting South Korea." That's a sign in South Korea that the food is delicious.
Oh.
You're complimenting the chef, by chewing with your mouth open. So that's culturally.
Sandra would have a tough time there. Lena, first time writing in for Lena. She writes, "As a science graduate and healthcare professional, I thoroughly enjoy and continue to learn from your show, but this episode is the one that prompted me to write to you."
Uh-oh.
She writes, after my separation, I dated for a while. I experienced the ick. For me, it was primarily around feet."
Oh, okay.
"Especially long toenails." And then she writes,
Again, I would argue that really long, unkempt toenails are a small but relevant signal that someone's hygiene, I mean, total hygiene, may not be in order, right?
Yeah.
There's this classic scene from the movie Dumb and Dumber where their grotesquely long toenails are being sanded down with like an auto mechanic grinder.
Yeah.
And the toenails are a sign that other things are wrong with these.
Exactly,
these
that's
guys.
An angle grinder that they're using on there. Lena also sent a bunch of what she called memes. I think these would be cartoons, because a meme is something that is shared a lot, right? That's what we learned.
Yeah.
But a couple of cartoons I got to mention here. The carbon dating. You got a piece of coal sitting there with a diamond, and the piece of coal goes, "Your profile picture, you're a lot older than your profile picture." And then the diamond goes, "I've been under a lot of pressure."
Wow.
Yeah.
That is some science humor.
725,000 pounds of pressure per square inch.
To turn carbon into a diamond.
Yeah.
To align
2,000 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, it's got to be hot. You can't make diamonds without pressure, as they say, often connected with sports or going up on a stage.
Yeah.
You need the pressure to create a diamond.
There's also a robot sitting in his cubicle. And he's asking another colleague, "Hey, can you come over here and click the I'm not a robot box for me?"
Oh, the CAPTCHA.
Yeah.
All those CAPTCHAs. Where you have to click the pictures.
Oh, man.
Is there a boat in this picture? Yes, yes. And then maybe, yeah, kind of a boat. Is that a boat? I'll click yes. Hopefully they don't think I'm a robot.
Love those, Lena.
Thank you for the cartoons. Yeah. And anyone looking to hear the discussion on memes and the danger of memes can go back to our episode from last week. That's available wherever you listen to any podcast. I will get into some more science. And first, I'll start with something that is a news story, really connected to an interview that we did almost a year ago. And that in that interview, we talked about the erosion of social norms and how to stop it. So our concrete example was if you're in a train or somewhere in public, really, and somebody pulls out their phone and they're listening to a video loudly.
Without headphones,
and it's super annoying. People don't really say anything, but then we want people to say anything. How do you do it? And it turns out that the best way to do it is if one person stands up to say something, hey, turn that speaker off, please, and another person supports them. Wonderful news in connection with that study or that research from France, from a train station in France. I don't know if you heard this, Gabe, but that is where in Nantes, a 54-year-old man whose name, at least in the press, is David, he was having a loudspeaker phone call with his sister.
Okay.
Which again begs the question, you don't even need headphones. A phone works without putting it on loudspeaker. You don't need to do that.
Everyone has their preferences.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the SNCF security staff, this is like the Deutsche Bahn of France, they walk over and say, hey, you need to turn that thing off because you're in a quiet zone here, or we're going to fine you €150. And the guy thought, haha, what are you talking about? Nobody gets fined for this. Get out of here.
Okay.
He thought it was a joke. Ignored it. They come back. He ends up getting a €200 fine, and he is now talking to his lawyer, apparently, and wants to fight it. I think this is wonderful news because it connects to what we discussed at the end of the show, something that wasn't happening, that should happen. So if we're
Your concrete example was Italy, right?
Yeah.
You said that social norm had eroded.
Right. And it is not the burden of the commuter to solve this situation. When you have a rail system or in airplanes, I've had to deal with this in airplanes, people listening to podcasts on speaker, and all these other people have to listen to it. They should take care of it. So in that case, the flight attendants or the staff or the security for the railway on buses, it's fundamentally probably their job, and having a fine associated with it, even if it doesn't happen too often just to scare people, I think that's great. I think it's going to hopefully lead toward a quieter public sphere. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't need to know which TikTok video you're watching as you scroll every 3 seconds. I don't need to listen to your podcast. I don't need to listen to your sister.
No, you don't.
There's already enough information out
there. No, you don't.
Yeah.
We're going to stick with the omnipresence of smartphones. There was a study out of University of Texas at Austin, Georgetown, Boston University, Universities of Alberta and British Columbia, looking into what that's the smart part. Being connected to the internet wherever you go with these devices, what happens when you turn that off? So the question they were looking into is, quote, if we were not constantly connected to the internet, would our cognitive and emotional well-being improve? And according to the data that they were able to collect in this experiment, absolutely. 467 individuals, average age 32, 63% female, split them into two groups in what is called a randomized controlled trial design. So that means for the first 2 weeks, half of these people had their internet turned off, their mobile internet turned off.
Mm-hmm.
The other half didn't, could use their phone unrestricted. For the last 2 weeks of the trial, completely switched, right? The people who weren't able to use their internet were able to, and the ones who weren't were able to, and then they compared them with regard to social well-being, with regard to emotional and subjective well-being and attention. So using an objective computer game that essentially measures your attention span.
Which is great, right? Because that's different than a me filling out a survey and not realizing I feel better even though I don't know. It takes some of the subjective aspect out of it.
Across the board, so 91% of the cases, I mean, that sounds like it's not being very detailed or specific, but across the board, only 9% of the people didn't get any benefits with regard to well-being or their attention span when the internet was turned off.
If you take 10 people, 9 of them will be feeling better or will have higher levels of attention after, 2 weeks?
Yes.
What's interesting is you can still do it at home. It's just when you're out walking about.
Yes.
That's it. If you ever dreamed of being a marine biologist, and a lot of people had that dream as a kid, one of the best places to do it would probably be on the island of Corsica, the French island famous as the birthplace of Napoleon. And
a lot of fish swimming there?
Yeah. On the northwest corner, there's the Stario Marine Biology Center, I guess is what it is, where together with the Max Planck Institute, they have established that fish can recognize different people if the people are sort of dressed differently. These were two divers who, over the course of 23 dives, went down with each guy. In this case, let's say it's two guys. Both of them had Ziploc bags with fish food in it, right? So Gabe, you and I go diving down. Mm-hmm. I think the depth was like four up to 8 meters. And there you hover. We would just hover for like 3 minutes so that these bream fish, two different kinds of bream fish, would start circling around us, right? They're used to people diving there, that there's a marine biology center. They know that people come in there sometimes. And after 3 minutes, you go 50 meters one way and I go 50 meters the other way. And now the fish kind of have to make a choice if they're going to follow us. Which one do I follow? And it turns out that every single time you pull out the bag and pull some fish food out and I don't, and the fish start to realize that Gabe, the one who has yellow fins, whereas Connor is wearing blue fins, Gabe, who has these patches on his BCD, his buoyancy device, like his life jacket, he's the one who always seems to have food. And this other guy, he gives us nothing.
So these fish are able to differentiate between the two of us because I give food and you don't give food, or because of our fins? Or,
well, they, in theory, if we were dressed exactly the same,
yeah,
black neoprene from head to toe, they might not know which one of us is the one that always has food.
Impossible.
Right.
But because the one with yellow fins, namely me,
yeah,
gave them food,
they're like, oh, yellow fin guy.
They gravitate immediately to me because they're just that smart.
Yellow fin guy is the food guy.
Okay.
And of course, who doesn't want food? Everyone wants food. And so they start to follow you. That they established. And then they kind of upped the challenge. Can they do it if they don't look that different from each other? If they're wearing exactly the same stuff, there it was pretty inconclusive. One group of these fish started to be able to do it and then gave up after a while. Again, inconclusive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just something to think about the next time you eat these fish. And that is what the authors themselves said. That wasn't the point of the study. The point was to establish whether or not they could do it. But we eat these fish here at DW. It's in the cafeteria sometimes. I think it might have been there this week. There was fish and chips. I don't know what kind of fish that was.
I didn't touch it.
No?
No.
Okay. Well, good for you. But
yeah. With the lentil soup.
Ooh, yeah. Hardy, does it matter to you at all that an animal you eat can recognize you? I mean, we can recognize them. They can recognize us. Does that make a difference to you? Do you plan to turn off the internet when you go out? It's kind of a big ask these days. It really is. Let us know.
Maybe you turned it off years ago. How do you feel? There are all kinds of different people out there, you know? Is your will free? Do you have free will?
You're asking me?
I'm asking everyone.
Human
beings, are we free to decide to do things?
Yeah, are all the steps along my very, in my mind, unique life, all these waypoints, all these tree branches, one of them being the woman I met and married.
Mm.
I saw her. I talked to her. Now I'm married to her. We have a family. Was that a choice? Did I choose that? Or did that happen? And was it always going to happen? Gigantic
yeah.
question that can be looked at scientifically.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably been debated for a very, very long time. In 1839, a German philosopher by the name of Schopenhauer philosophically more or less said it's impossible. Everything is determined. You'd have to explain the Big Bang before you explain why you put on a green sweater this morning.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do it perfect. I love the sweater I got on right now.
I would have called it olive. Gabe, you can't see this, but Gabe has an Arthur Schopenhauer book next to him, and we're about to go to a Max Planck Institute director who has looked into this very question and to the best that one can, has tried to give an answer based on neurobiology.
Science Unscripted.
Yeah, okay. So hi, I'm Helvig Bayer. I'm at the Max Planck Institute for Biological Intelligence. And I'm interested in neuroscience. We work with little fish that make decisions and navigate their environment. And as a hobby, I've been interested also in philosophical questions that touch on my subject of research. And one of my interests is in free will.
And Helvig, what does science tell us about whether human beings have a free will?
Okay, so that's, you're jumping straight into the middle of the debate. Yeah, I'm not so sure if neuroscience can deliver the answer to this question. So we have to, we have to talk to philosophers, and free will hinges on a few assumptions, and we can talk about those.
What are the assumptions upon which free will is based?
So three things have to be true in order for free will to exist. One is that there has to be agency. Then the second is there have to be options, right? So you have to be able to make decisions and choices, and the future cannot be 100% determined, predetermined. So determinism is just not compatible with free will. And the third criterion is mental causation. So this is where neuroscientists become very excited and very interested. So that basically means that our thought processes, our cognitive, inner workings in the brain have to have an effect on our decisions. It cannot be just sort of synaptic mechanisms and molecular processes and chemical reactions and electrical signals. So there has to be an effect of psychology on behavior.
So in the case of the proverbial moth that cannot help but fly toward like a lamp that's shining at nighttime, that wouldn't be free will because it's not a choice. It's like as soon as that lamp turns on, there's no psychological process. It's just a drifting toward it.
Well, you can argue that it's still psychology. I mean, you can have a very strong instinct that guides your choices, but, in this case, a sort of a program inside the brain that drives behavior wins. But, maybe a moth, after it has reached the light, can, decide to still explore the environment. And, there's kind of a continuum of choices. So I would not exclude, the existence of a free will in an insect.
Let's dissect a different species now. Homo sapiens sapiens. When we do things, we have choices, right? We most certainly have intention, agency. We have choices. But philosophers might say that we are not free because we can't control the factors or the motivations that lead to that, feeling of having a choice? Or why exactly would you even say that the will is not free to begin with?
Well, I think there are, different school of thoughts that challenge these, each of these three criteria, right? So the one that you mentioned of having a choice, that's challenged by determinism. So meaning the universe, since the Big Bang, has been unfolding and, each state leads to sort of a future state, just a little, a short time thereafter and so forth and into the future. So it is possible, and, many very respected physicists actually subscribe to this view, that there is no free will because there's only one way in which the future can happen.
You said in your introduction that you deal with little fishies. What do those fish, what can they contribute to this debate, or what can they tell us about free will or volition or whether we have any say in anything here?
I think they can tell us something about how decisions are made in the brain. So decisions are real. They're not an illusion, for sure. The brain is kind of a bit of a parliament with lots of you know, voices and negotiations going on all the time. And whatever behavior the fish chooses to do in the next moment is a result of these negotiations. And we are studying that part of the fish's behavior.
Meaning what exactly? What exactly are you looking at?
So we look at different behavioral choices that the fish is making. For instance, when the fish is confronted with a moving dot on a computer screen, which we are exposing the fish to, the fish can decide, is that something that I should approach? Maybe it's an edible thing. It may be moving in the right, like my prey items move. So I better check it out and maybe even, you know, try to capture it. It could also be a predator that is, you know, lurking, and, you know, it may actually be approaching me. And we can simulate that on the computer screen by an expanding disk, right? So the small dot turns into a bigger, bigger, bigger dot. And we can see how the fish responds to that. And they sometimes swim towards that dot, and sometimes they swim away from the dot. And we found in the brain neurons and neuronal circuitries that, you know, carry out this negotiation and make the decision.
And from a neuroscientist's point of view, there have been experiments in the past that have shown that a free will doesn't necessarily exist, because it can be shown that there's activity in the brain 0.2 seconds before, let's say, my arm, I choose to move my right arm. There's activity in my brain that precedes that.
Yes. Yeah, so these are the famous Stanley Libet experiments. So basically the experiment is very simple. You ask a subject, a person, to report a decision. So the person is asked to raise their hand and report when she or he made the decision to raise the hand. And at the same time, you know, electroencephalogram of the brain is measured, and there's a certain preparatory signal that precedes the raising of the arm, and that also precedes the reporting of the decision. So Libet and his team interpreted this to mean that free will is an illusion. The brain is already knowing that the subject will raise his arm before the subject is aware or conscious of this decision.
One thing I like, maybe the only thing I like, about the idea of not having free will, if you were to zoom all the way out, that everything is deterministic, all these molecules and atoms are in motion, they were always going to happen this way, is that it gives me kind of more empathy or compassion for people who do things that outrage me, or that are against my ethos or something, right? It was always going to be that. It's not their fault. It was always going to happen that way. Is, I guess, my question for you, is that one, I don't know, one of the nice conclusions one can draw from assuming people don't actually have a free will, that everything was always going to happen this way? We're not really in control. Just let it be.
I think you're touching on this other aspect of free will, which is the ethical aspect, right? So the responsibility aspect. And as a neuroscientist, I cannot say much about that, but I can absolutely empathize with the and sympathize with the, you know, with the attitude, with the of you know, giving people a pass for misdeeds. And you know, one thing to consider, of course, is that it is not an absolution. If free will does not exist, it doesn't mean that we should not that it doesn't matter how we behave. So there is a case to be made that people who commit crimes should be punished, because that punishment is a deterrence to others who are thinking about doing something bad. And I don't think it will, you know, the absence of a free will does not mean that we should not punish crime and that we should not reward accomplishment anymore. It is a discussion for philosophers and maybe a little bit for scientists.
No, I think it absolutely is a question not only for neuroscientists or philosophers or psychiatrists, for human beings. If this was all going to happen anyway, how can it still matter? It was all going to happen anyway. No matter what I do, it was just going to happen anyway. That nothing matters then.
Yeah, but you don't know what you're going to do. I mean, we cannot predict our own behavior, right? We don't have all the information. So one factor is, of course, how others look at us. And this will be part of that deterministic clockwork, basically, right? So society is part of that. And it does matter. I mean, it does matter whether we live well and whether our fellow human beings live well. So, I mean, but we're in the middle of that philosophy and this ethical discussion, which, philosophers have been debating for a long time.
Hervig, you and I and Gabe are all talking to each other. I guess this is to kind of sum up all of your thoughts on free will. Did we have the free will to choose to choose this conversation, make it happen? Or was it just this inevitable thing that was always going to happen because the molecules have been rolling around and knocking into each other in such a way that we got born and we ended up here and this was just going to happen?
Well, I don't think so. I think free will exists. Can I logically deduce it from my science? No. Is there a sort of internally consistent philosophy that logically leads us to that conclusion? No. But I'd like to think that, the three of us made the choice to talk to each other and that we had other options. And I think we have to, wait for an answer. Maybe we'll never get there.
I'm glad you made that choice, Hervig.
Are you glad that you made that choice?
I did. It was fun. Thank you very much.
That was Hervig Bayer speaking to us from Munich, down in Bavaria. And I'm just reading his Wikipedia page right now. I didn't realize this guy's pretty big. Head of the Department Genes, Circuits, Behavior. He's a director at the Max Planck Institute.
Yeah. Honor. And he, at the end there.
For biological intelligence.
After we finished the recording with him, if you're still left wondering, like, wait, what is the answer? I'm not sure. I don't quite get it. That's fair. This is an open-ended question. I think if this interview confirmed anything for me and hopefully for you out there listening, it's that it's okay if somebody's like, if you're sitting at a bar and they're like, oh, is there free will, to say, we don't know that. We don't know that based on all of the things we've seen scientifically. I think that's one of the points that he was trying to make. There is no closed question.
Yeah. Regardless of what scientific field you come from, and he mentioned a few there, psychology, philosophy, neuroscience, there is no definitive answer to whether or not we can choose the things that we end up, our course of action.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we are free to do that, we don't know. So you can answer it. Were you free to listen to this program all the way to the end? You made it all the way to the end of this discussion.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? And are you happy that you did? Same question to you guys as we posed to Hervig. What did you get from this discussion? What do you get from this show? What do you get from anything? Because it's all open right now.
SU@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.